Victory or death!
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 Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon, the voice of freedom behind enemy lines in the Commonwealth of Virginia, attempting to give you the information you need to stay in the fight to preserve your liberty, which is getting harder and harder to do these days, but we will continue to fight. Hopefully with words. Hopefully we can solve it with that. But I don't think so. This is episode 2112, the 12th episode of 2021. I'm going to be talking about a couple different things. Crazy times in Loudoun with a bunch of psychos. Learn more about that in a second. Kids are still not back in school. I was surprised at this because I drive by the schools all the time and I see the signs are flashing. But overall, across the state, across the Commonwealth, the children are not in school. So I guess it's not all about the children. But those schools are still getting paid. We'll talk about that a little bit. Then give you an update on the RPV, Republican Party of Virginia, and what's going on with that and why you should care. And I'll be doing another chapter. In fact, I think it's my favorite chapter of I Led Three Lives, chapter 15. We start this off with actually two different stories unrelated about schools. This one from the Washington Times, a group of teachers and others in Loudoun County, Virginia, compiled a blacklist of parents who they felt disagreed with the school's teaching of critical race theory in an effort to humiliate them online. The blacklist was in part to infiltrate, to use hackers to silence parents' communications, and to expose people publicly, the Daily Wire first reported. Loudoun County has long been at the forefront of woke progressivism, so they are part of the woke industrial complex. It was the school district which first took aim at Dr. Seuss books for their strong racial undertones. Oh, brother. Last year, it dedicated nearly $500,000. Holy cow. $500,000 on programs designed to counter systemic bias and oppression. How? Last year, how? School wasn't even in. How the heck do you dedicate $500,000 on programs when you're not even in school? The coaching and training sessions focused on uncovering personal and institutional biases that prevent all people, and especially people of color, from reaching their fullest potential with oppression analysis, learning theory, and coaching for change. As in, you suck, whitey. Stop being white. Parents concerned these teachings may sow more discord by focusing on our differences and grievances rather than on what unites us have been called out. According to the Daily Wire, Loudoun County Public School Board member Beth Bartz recommended in a Facebook post last week for members to call out statements and actions that undermine our stated plan to end systemic racism. The recommendation quickly devolved into members compiling a list of parents who may not be supportive of the school system focus on critical race theory. The list included dozens of parents, many times where they lived, their employers' and spouses' names. They also erred on the side of accusing the innocent, the Daily Wire reported. In response to one name added, another member asked, "Why is she on the list? I haven't seen her support anti-CRT." The response, "I put a question mark next to her because I'm curious about some of her comments, re the Dr. Seuss nonsense and racial equality generally. Happy to remove if I'm off the mark." No, I wouldn't go so far as to take her off. However, from what I've seen, she's very carefully neutral," the parent replied. The Sheriff's Criminal Investigation Division is reviewing the matter, the Daily Wire reported. Meanwhile, the cult of racial essentialism grows stronger each day in Loudoun County. Now, I realize it's different depending on where you are in the Commonwealth. You may like to lie to yourself and tell yourself, "Well, my son's teachers, they're all Christians. They're wonderful people." Well, that may be. But they're not the ones making the decisions about what gets taught at the school system in Virginia. That's made by people like this. the people that want to have critical race theory, want to get rid of Dr. Seuss. These people, I don't know if you can tell the tone of voice that they're speaking with, but it's very similar to those that you would find in I Led Three Lives. So think about that as you send little Johnny and Susie off to the government indoctrination centers once again, if they're open for you. And that brings us to our next story from The Bull Elephant by guest contributor Ken Reed. It's March 15th. Are your kids back in school? Most major school districts defy Northam's order, fearing wrath of unions and voters who work for schools. Voters who work for schools. They care what the voters who work for schools think. There's that many people working for schools? Then that industry is way too big, if that's the case. On February 5th, the worst governor Virginia has had since the integration resistors of the 1960s, Ralph Blackface Northam, made the dramatic decision to be the first governor in the nation to order public schools to reopen March 15th. Just 11 months after being among the first governors in the nation to close them due to the panic over COVID-19. The media wrote the story as if Northam ordered this, but within a day or so, it was apparent Blackface had no such authority. Apparently, state law allows him to close the schools for an emergency, but not to reopen them. Well, now, wait just a second. I'm pretty sure there's an easy solution to this, and that is to just cancel all the executive orders. Problem solved. If they are no longer ordered to close, then they are no longer restricted from being open. And they would be violating probably other state laws that say you have to actually conduct your schools, you lazy bums. And so here's the totals. 51 have partial in-person, 9 partial hybrid, 4 fully remote. 4 fully remote, holy cow. 31 all hybrid. According to the State Department of Education, and you can read the definitions of in-person, all hybrid, and see a map of each school district, and you can do that here. And among those that are hybrid are the largest school districts in the state. Fairfax, Prince William, Loudoun. We talked about them. Arlington and Alexandria plus Stafford and Spotsylvania. In Hampton Roads, all but Portsmouth schools have some form of reopening, but not full reopening. This means that most Virginia students are not back in school for in-person learning, and this is a real shame and a decision that will cost the taxpayers of the state and a nation dearly in terms of catching up with education. I'm going to keep reading and then I'll give you my comments. The cause of this, of course, are school employee unions and their unholy alliance with the Democratic Party, whose leaders seem unwilling to stand up for students and parents. But it goes beyond the teachers' unions, though they have been the most vocal in keeping schools closed. As I noted in a previous article, in July, the local schools are a major employer and these folks vote. Well, let them vote. You got to go back to work, you bum. In Loudoun County, where I served in elected office for 10 years, the county's Economic Development Department estimated the schools have more than 10,000 employees. Oh my gosh. Based on 2015 data, about 50% of these employees lived in the county and thus vote in the county. That's a significant voting block if you are running in an off year, low turnout election. No wonder the school boards in those big counties of Virginia have not moved to opening schools. Despite the pressure from parents and the media and politicians, at least Republicans, I do not foresee all Virginia schools reopening to full classroom instruction until September. And he goes on, talks about a bunch of different stuff here. So while I'm frustrated because as a taxpayer, 2/3 of my taxes, at least at the county level, go to fund these useless institutions. However, isn't it a good thing when you have people like what we just talked about over in Loudoun? Isn't that a good thing to not have the schools being open? I think that's fantastic. This is great. The kids are not being properly indoctrinated. That's a wonderful thing. And it is true, though, what he said about the quality of education. Let's assume that these young people are getting properly educated, which I don't believe. But let's just assume that they were. then you have to make the argument then that they're not in this environment being properly educated. And that's a detriment to our society because we're told all the time, well, don't you want to have an educated society? Don't you want to have the best of the best and brightest? Well, yeah, I've always wanted that, but you don't provide that. You didn't provide that for me when I was growing up. I had an algebra teacher that treated us all like we were blithering idiots. And so that's what I thought until I went to college and I realized, oh, this is problem solving. This is easy. It's not arithmetic. It's a piece of cake. I'm not an idiot. Go figure. And I realized that that's not the norm. I hope that's not the norm. I know that most people don't go into teaching thinking, hey, I want to give tests and treat students like they're stupid. But there are those that can't, and so they teach. But overall, you know, with the young people not being in school right now, it's like, kind of think of it like this. You're hitting the pause button on these young people's lives because everything builds on everything else. And if you're a year behind, which means you're a year and a half to 2 years behind because it's going to take you a year to catch up if you were to go full speed right now. And the schools aren't going full speed. Our local schools here are not going full speed. The dumb, stupid 25-mile-an-hour signs on all the time. And I drive by, I'm like, where is everybody? Is nobody here? Because they leave the thing on. But there's a crossing guard guy, and he's sitting in his car. He doesn't have anything to do because they, I guess, forgot to tell him to stay home. Or because it's some weird hybrid model where, you know, people with the letter S in their last name are allowed to go to school on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or some silly thing like that. And that's, well, it's pretty ridiculous. So, as I've said before, get your kids out of that system. I spent $12,000 a year to send my kids to private school. Now, I'd much rather spend that $12,000 on a new F-250 or a boat or an RV or a lake house or any number of things that I could spend that money on. So maybe some ATVs, maybe, you know, I don't know, some jet skis. I mean, who knows? There's a limitless supply of things that I could spend $12,000 a year on. So don't tell me you can't get your kids out of that system because you can. You could if you wanted to. You could homeschool them. You could unschool them. Frankly, I think they'd be better off not being schooled than going to those systems. And, but hey, you know, do what you want. They're your children. And hopefully they won't come home one day saying, Mommy, I'm pregnant and I'm a lesbian. Who knows? All right, moving on here. Sean Kenny's somebody I talked about a couple shows back, and he was talking about the RPV, the Republican Party of Virginia, and the cluster disaster mess that this convention process has become. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. It really is. Now, they've kind of figured it out, and so I'm going to talk about that. Why is this important? Because we need, in Virginia, if for no other reason to hit the pause button on communist advancements, we need to take back the House, the Senate, the Attorney General, and the Governor, and the Lieutenant Governor. We need to take all those seats. And to do that, we're not going to do that with a third party. It's not going to happen. It isn't. And we've got this insanity happening right now in the Republican Party. Is finally figured it out. So here it is. After much sturm and drang, the RPV State Central Committee has chosen the unassembled convention with 37 locations to be determined across the Commonwealth on Saturday, May 8th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Wunderbar. So now comes the hard part. First and foremost, RPV State Central has to pull off this unassembled convention alongside our district committees. This may not be an easy task, as 8 gubernatorial candidates are hoovering in endorsements and trumpeting each one as a minor political coup. Precisely, how many disinterested or non-committed poll workers will be left to run the unassembled conventions is anyone's guess. Want to file to be a delegate at the RPV convention? Follow these helpful steps. And he's got some links. I will have this linked in the show notes, which you can find at radiofreeva.podbean.com. Or make it simple, just go to radiofreeva.com and click the link that'll take you there. But you've got a list of things you have to do. Do this as soon as you can. It says some localities have yet to publish their calls, but some deadlines are as soon as March 18th. And I'll go into detail about what a call is and all that stuff. On it goes into April with the dates which you have to have done all that paperwork and everything. So what is a call? A call is a committee will send out a call for interested voters that have to basically say, yes, I agree with the Republican creed, blah, blah, blah. And I want to go to this convention. And then you go, and then it looks like they're going to do some weird drive-up thing, I guess, details to be determined or to be announced. 37 locations, good golly. And they are, then you're going to drive up, say, I support Dr. Seuss. I mean, whatever, I don't know. Here's my list of candidates that I support, and you basically vote, and then those committees will all pool all that information together, and that will determine who the next candidates are going to be. And looking at it, and one of the things I'm going to do in an upcoming show here is actually look at these candidates for you so that you can make an informed decision. There's only a couple I know off the top of my head, so it would be fairly pointless to go over those, okay? So obviously feel free to contact your favorite campaign and file your delegate filing form with them or file directly with your unit chairman. The process will be somewhat haphazard. Give everyone a bit of grace and latitude if you can. We're on the same side after all. Of course, that's the easy part. The second and perhaps more difficult part is to set some parameters so that A, when one candidate emerges, B, the integrity of the process remains intact, and C, nasty campaigning, not the negative campaigning, is kept to a basic minimum. So what he's talking about is the mudslinging. There's a difference between negative campaigning, saying I'm better than Bob because I was in the military. Well, okay. I'm better than Bob because, you know, he beats his wife every night. Don't you know that? That's nasty campaigning. If your mailbox is overflowing with mail, I know mine is. Don't worry about it. Put it in the circular file, i.e. the trash can. That's what I've been doing. Here's what he recommends. Listen to what the candidates are telling you about themselves. Find out what they're willing to bleed for and what they have bled for. What are they wearing on their sleeves in a way that sets them apart from the rest? And he goes on and on and talks about the different things. So he says, this is the important part. There's 53 days left until the May 8th state convention. One suspects that it will get real nasty. The last 3 weeks in, just be aware there is a war on for your mind. That negative and nasty campaigning works by triggering the fight or flight mechanism in your amygdala. Fight or flight mechanism in your brain, convincing you that the attack must be true because the emotions you feel are true. Okay? So, the convention is sorted. It will be May 8th at some location, miraculously to be determined. So, if that's something you're into, that stuff, or you want to check that out, I'll possibly go. I don't know. I mean, if it was a real convention, I think it would be newsworthy to bring the mic and talk to people, but a drive-through convention, I don't know. We'll see. Depends on where it is. I might go. I want to thank ActiCare of the Blue Ridge for sponsoring this episode. ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. ActiCare is in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. So if you live in the Smith Mountain Lake, Bedford, Roanoke, Campbell County, Lynchburg, out in the country, give John and his team a call. Get in touch with them, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge, and they will take good care of you. And mention you heard them here on Radio Free Virginia.
ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Herbert A. Philbrick.
What is communism? I've been on the inside of communism. I still have contacts. From this knowledge, I tell you as simply and seriously as I know how. Communism is a lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, murderous, determined, as J. Edgar Hoover says, a criminal conspiracy. I'm choosing these words deliberately. Lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, determined, and international criminal conspiracy. This is the true nature of the enemy. This is communism.
Chapter 15, A New Assignment, Pro 4. By the spring of 1947, my work shifted back to the political treadmill, and a period of frustration and comparative inactivity followed. The Communist Party moved along with the old Political Action Committee into the coalition Progressive Citizens of America, the Third Party Movement. Dr. Harlow Shapley of Harvard was elected honorary chairman of the organization that was eventually to become the Progressive Party. Angus Cameron, at that time editor-in-chief of Little Brown and Company, was the chairman, Ruth Emery the secretary, and Marjorie Lansing the executive director. I did not have a position on the executive committee of this group as I had in the PAC, but I was asked to serve on the publicity committee, and this was sufficient to the purposes of the Communist Party to get me in with adequate cover. I attended a series of meetings in a cramped little two-room office suite at 6 Beacon Street on one of the upper floors of the building. It was in the same building as the offices of the Republican Party. The founding convention of the Progressive Citizens of America in Massachusetts was held in Boston, March 7, 1947, and for weeks thereafter, our main effort in the publicity committee was organizational. The monotonous conduct of drives to enroll new members pending the launching of a third-party campaign for the 1948 elections. Hal Leary repeated and paraphrased the same admonition he had given me in connection with the Anthony Roche campaign. We are not interested in the Progressive Citizens of America as long as it remains a normal political movement, but we are interested in what the Communist Party is doing and planning to do in it. In an effort to run this down for the Bureau, I attended scores of afternoon teas, rallies, receptions, and soirees, many of them intimate little gatherings held in middle and upper class homes in fashionable suburban areas and town apartments. They were usually called to honor a distinguished guest in connection with the PCA organization, and they always managed to tap those who attended for sums ranging from $5 to $100 or more. These affairs catered to the liberals in Boston professional life, writers, doctors, lawyers, businessmen, and their wives. There were very few among them, or among the 40 to 50 regular workers at PCA headquarters, whom I recognized as members of the Communist Party. The few I did encounter were small cogs in the machine, and I had little interest in them. For several reasons, I felt uneasy. I seemed to be moving away from my central interest in all of these activities, counter-spy work for the FBI and the Communist Party, and I was afraid that inactivity was making me careless and undermining my usefulness. After one of these lengthy and dull meetings, I became so disturbed that I called Hal Leary and made an appointment to meet him. "Good," he said over the phone when I talked to him from a pay station. "I have something to talk to you about also." We arranged the contact for the following Monday at a small cafeteria in Porter Square, Cambridge. I made my way there by subway and emerged in a cold spring rain. It was a little before 6 by the bank clock on the corner. I was to meet Hal at 6 o'clock sharp. The restaurant, almost empty, reverberated to the blare of a jukebox in the corner. I bought a light meal at the serving counter and carried my tray to a white marble-topped table at the side of the room facing the door, where I could watch for Hal's arrival. The first man who entered after me had his rain-spattered coat collar turned up around his throat. As he walked down the center of the room without looking at me, I recognized him as a Communist Party grubber I had seen around the PCA office. I bent down to my food as he passed me, giving myself a moment to consider my situation. I was indeed getting careless. Was I being tailed again, and without even suspecting it? It seemed unlikely, and this man's appearance was more probably a coincidence, but I could not risk being seen talking to Hal Leary now. The door opened again and Hal entered. He was in the company of another man, who was a stranger to me, and they were engaged in jovial and animated conversation. I waited until Hal looked in my direction for a cue. Then I picked up my glass of water, deliberately quaffed a drink while returning his gaze impassively, and set the glass down. The prearranged signal that the contact must be broken. Hal and his companion continued their conversation, went to the order counter, and then took another table apart from me. All four of us, the FBI agent and his friend, the spy, and the communist, ate with complete indifference to the presence of the others. I watched the comrade across the room. He was reading a book, apparently oblivious to the dramatic little tableau in the almost empty restaurant. I wondered if he really had followed me. If so, it would not do for me to dash out now, after throwing the government agents off our rendezvous. I decided it would be better to conclude matters on an explanatory note. If he was a shadow, I might be able to satisfy him of my innocence. If not, my approaching him could do no harm. I fished out my pipe and tobacco pouch and idled over to his table. "Hello there," I greeted him. He started from his book and his face betrayed open surprise. I was convinced he had not even known I was in the restaurant. "Can you help me out with some matches for this stoker?" I asked. "Why, sure," he said, producing a folder of paper matches. "I didn't see you there." He wasn't putting on an act. "What are you doing?" "Oh," I said, making a ceremony of lighting my pipe. "I had a late business deal in this neighborhood, and I thought I'd grab a quick bite. Join me?" "Thanks, but I'm just finishing my coffee. Have to run along." I handed back the matches. "Keep them," he said. "I have more." I made some inconsequential comment about the rain, walked back to my table, and finished my coffee. Then I arose without looking in Hal's direction again, nodded a farewell to the comrade, and left the restaurant. Hal and his companion stayed behind, making no effort to follow me. I walked to a bus terminal waiting room, making sure this time I was not being followed. I purchased a newspaper and sat for 10 minutes or so, as if waiting for a bus. Then, when I calculated that Hal had had time to finish his meal and leave the restaurant, I went to a telephone booth and dialed a number. "Sorry about the mix-up," I said, when his voice crackled over the radio telephone circuit. "Thought my friend might become curious." "Okay," Hal replied. "We caught the idea. Hop a cab and meet us at Smith's house in about 10 minutes, he told me. This time I spotted Hal and his friend in a side booth at Smith's, and he signaled that we were all right. I joined them for a belated second cup of coffee and dessert. "I want you to meet Don Richards," Hal said right off without ceremony. "He's going to be your contact man from now on." "Oh?" I said, shaking hands. Richards had reddish blonde hair and a boyish face. His greeting was friendly but reserved. Hal volunteered nothing more on the switch. I wanted to ask him what was up, but I knew it wouldn't get me anywhere. The change was accepted, and the subject was dropped after Hal said, "That's the only thing on my mind. Wanted you two to get acquainted. What's on yours?" I directed my attention now to Agent Don Richards, since he was the one directly concerned. "I'm a little confused," I confessed. "The party has tossed me into this progressive citizens movement, and I'm in it so deep that there isn't time for me to keep on with party cell activities. It's defeating me. Instead of getting closer to the comrades, I think I'm getting farther away from them." "That ought to be a pleasure," Hal interrupted with a smile. "It is, in a way. They're a different sort of people, and it's nice enough to work with them and get out of the morass of Marxism a little bit. But the trouble is, I'm afraid it isn't much use to you." "What sort of work are you doing with this bunch?" Richards asked. "Publicity, for the most part. And then, too, I go to a lot of tea parties for prominent people who call themselves liberals, but who are actually fellow travelers. Mostly they raise money. Good Lord, they took in $2,500 at 2 meetings in a row the other night. Small affairs, too. Both of them. But where does it get me? You said yourself you didn't care about investigating this outfit." "Well," Hal said, "let's see now. Any other commies besides you in there?" "Sure, here and there. But they aren't important, and I don't tangle much with them. That's why I thought we had better talk about it. Take this meeting the other night. A lot of important people, wealthy ones, too. But I didn't run into a soul that I knew in the party. Not one." "Who was there?" Richards persisted. I observed that he had a brisk, businesslike manner, precise and to the point. I rattled off a list of names, drawn from my best recollection of the affair. "No communists there," Richards mused. If he suppressed a grin, I failed to detect it. "None that I know of. And I think I can spot him across the street by this time." "Tell you what," Richards said. I think you better stick with it. After all, you were in there on Communist Party orders, and there must be others too. I think it will turn out all right. I continued my work in the Progressive Citizens of America, grinding out publicity material, extolling the new Henry Wallace line of peace and abundance, which he was already outlining from speaking platforms throughout the country. It seemed advisable not to attempt to disguise my third-party activities from my everyday associates, but openly avow them. Otherwise, I might trip myself up. After all, the Progressive Citizens were not yet recognized as a communist front. Around the MNP theater office, therefore, I was known as a Wallace supporter, and I even kept PCA literature supporting his movement in plain view on my desk. However, I took care not to become too vocal, and by all means to avoid being drawn into any political discussions with pro or anti-Wallace members of the office staff. One morning in late summer, when we were starting work on a publicity campaign for Wallace's appearance in Boston toward the end of September, a special messenger brought into the office an envelope with the letterhead of the PCA. It turned out to be a memorandum on a routine matter. Typewritten, but scrawled across the bottom of it, was a penciled notation in a hand which I recognized. "Call FH," was all it said. "Fanny Hartman." It was the first direct communication I had received from the Communist Party leadership in some time. The morning was busy, and before I was able to comply with the message, which meant that I would have to leave my office and phone from a pay station, I in turn received a telephone call. Over the wire came the Harvard-accented voice of one of the top leaders of the PCA, asking me to meet him for lunch at Marlave's to discuss some of the arrangements for the Wallace appearance. This man, whom I shall call Harry, was, to my view, an insufferable, overeducated bore, a rich dilettante who dabbled in writing of sorts, and in business enterprises which he did not need for his support. He lived in comfortable good taste. He was a fairly common mixture, a snob who professed to be a liberal. But Harry did hold down an important job in the Progressive Party movement, and out of a sense of duty, I agreed to meet him. After all, I thought, my job is to stick at it, and one thing might lead to another. It always has. At the appointed hour, therefore, I turned down the blind lane of Bosworth Street, beyond the Parker House, and met Harry at Marlave's. We chatted idly, while the waiter brought our meal, and when he moved away, Harry leaned across, and in the seclusion of our booth, he almost whispered, "Have you heard from Fanny?" For a fraction of a second, the question failed to register. I lowered my fork and scrutinized his sensitive face for a clue. He must, I thought, be talking about someone else, surely not Fanny Hartman. I reflected on a girl on the PCA staff who was named Frances, but who was sometimes called Fanny. And yet, this name was mentioned within 2 hours of the note to me from Fanny Hartman, asking me to call her. It was inconceivable to me that Harry would be on first-name speaking terms with the hierarchy of the Communist Party, or that he should even know who they were. Harry leveled his gaze at me. "Who?" I asked. I was trying to set it straight in my mind just how much this man knew. "Fanny," he repeated, and it was spoken in the same conspiratorial whisper. But he didn't give me the full name. With a glance at my plate, I decided to play it straight and let him do the tactical maneuvering. "No," I said, "I haven't seen her at all recently. She's still in the office, isn't she?" Harry seemed a little confused himself, now as if he feared he might be on thin ice. He changed the subject abruptly. Then he suddenly excused himself with a glance at his watch, muttering that he had to make a telephone call. A few minutes later he returned, his uneasiness gone and his composure entirely regained. He toyed with a fork with long, delicate fingers. "Fanny tells me she left word for you to call," he said. And now I knew for sure what he was talking about. In his absence, I concluded, he had telephoned Communist headquarters to make certain there had not been some mistake. While he worked on his meal for a moment, I tried to accept the disclosure that this strange, wealthy, ineffectual, but fairly well-respected Bostonian, who moved in the highest civic, social, and business circles in the city, was a communist. He was apparently a bona fide member of the party, and even his close acquaintances could not have known it. He was far up enough in the party scale to be used evidently as a courier, for he was saying, "There's a new group to be formed in Pro 4, and Fanny says..." I felt myself start violently. "What did you say?" "I said..." His cultivated voice came back softly. "A new group is to be formed in Pro 4. and Fanny says that there will be another change in your assignment. Another one? I forced a smile. The cryptic designation, Pro 4, catapulted my mind back 3 years to the 1944 state convention. That was the curious symbol that Fanny Hartman had scribbled on my credentials to get me into the convention. Pro 4. It was the second time in my party life that I had encountered the strange term. It was still a complete mystery to me. What is the group? I asked. Where will it meet? I was still trying to adjust myself to the realization that this man was a secret member of the Communist Party. At its highest levels, a courier of messages too sensitive to convey by any method except word of mouth. At the same time, I realized with horror, he was swinging powerful influence in the new political movement of the Progressive Citizens of America. I thought I knew all of the comrades in the PCA, the little grubbers, but here was something else again. A wealthy college man who had no discernible cause for any complaint against society. Perhaps this was the brand of adolescent idealism on which the communists had capitalized. You'll find out all about it, Harry was saying. We will probably meet in Cambridge, perhaps in Boston. I think you'll like the general tone of the membership. It's useful work, too, and important, vitally important. What about my present group in Melrose? You will drop it. Drop out. Any explanation? None is necessary. I told him that I had a meeting scheduled that very evening with my cell, at which I was to be a discussion leader. He suggested that I go ahead with it. After that, the courier continued, as if delineating an order. You will become a floater. You will receive further instructions. In the meantime, don't go near the headquarters. Break off all contacts with Melrose and any other groups. Don't say anything. Just drop out. You will no longer affiliate with members on an official or even social basis. A floater, I knew, was a party member separated for security reasons from all normal party cells and organizations. He is a party freelance agent who is contacted only by courier, mail drop, or covert telephone calls. He holds no regular jobs with the party that bring him in touch with other members in large groups. The floater is but one step removed from the sleeper, who is ordered to drop completely out of communist life, sever all his relations with the party, including the leadership, until he is called upon for a particular mission, perhaps years hence. In the meantime, he leads a normal life, with all traces of his communist ties banished, both in and out of the party. It may even intentionally be made known to the party circles that he has been dropped out for disciplinary purposes or is an undesirable. Both floaters and sleepers have been used in communist espionage and underground circles for many years, in all countries, as a means of concealment. For instance, the Rosenbergs, American communists who were executed in Sing Sing prison for stealing vital atom bomb secrets for the Soviet Union, had been sleepers. Back in the office after lunch, I struggled the rest of the day between the work I had to do and the shock of my discovery. I was so stunned that I was unable to concentrate. The office closed and I stayed on alone to clean up my desk. A little after 6 o'clock, when the switchboard was unattended and it was safe to talk, I called Don Richards. I apparently haven't been so out of touch with things as I thought, I admitted. No? In fact, I've been working right next to one of the boys for weeks and never knew it. I'll file on him. Did you ever hear of Pro 4? He didn't answer my question. What do you know about it? He asked instead. I've been invited to join a new group. Good. Don't be too anxious. Did they set a time? Not yet. I've got to close out my other affairs first. They will let me know. I don't even know where. Fine. Send me all the details on your friend. Don't worry, I declared. I won't forget him. I followed the orders given to me by Harry, and appeared that evening for the last time at the Melrose cell meeting. Then, except for a few PCA activities, I dropped my party connections and waited. It was a long wait, and a welcome relief from the communist merry-go-round. Several weeks went by before I received a telephone call from Harry. We're having a small gathering tomorrow night, he said cheerfully. Can you meet me at Revere and Charles Street at 8? I assented. By the way, will you pick up some material at the bookshop? They know about it. Get it ahead of time. It would be better, easier, perhaps not to come directly from the shop. I understood that he was again stressing a tight security policy. I picked up the educational material that afternoon at the Progressive Bookshop, using an alias Arthur Trowbridge. Then I dropped a message to Don Richards informing him that the meeting was to be held somewhere in the vicinity of Revere and Charles, but adding that I had not been given the street address. In the autumn darkness of the next evening, I waited on the corner of Revere and Charles until Harry drove up. He parked his car, and together we walked up the Revere Street hill a few feet from the corner and turned into an apartment at number 6. Lugging my heavy satchel of party literature, I puffed up 2 flights of steep, narrow wooden stairs, at the top of which Harry knocked at the door. It was opened by a large, round-cheeked, and effusive brunette girl with a hearty hostess manner. She was introduced to me only as Norma. We passed through the cheerful foyer of the apartment toward a doorway leading to the living room. In the door, I paused for a breath and surveyed the room. On the sofa, and in comfortable chairs ringing the room, there were 6 or 8 persons, most of them women. Some of them conversed in pairs. Others regarded me cordially and without obvious curiosity. There was an atmosphere of pleasant sociability. Norma took me by the arm. "Come in and join us," she urged. Never had I seen a more innocent-looking gathering. The members of Pro 4, a cell of the professional group, Communist Party USA. "Come in," Norma said again. But I was frozen in the doorway, rooted to the spot. There on the sofa, slouched in the shadows, and not at first apparent, watching me with a slow smile on his massive face, was a man, an old friend, the last man in the world I would have ever expected to find at a meeting of a Communist Party cell. The big man in the rumpled suit regarded me with a level gaze. The satchel suddenly felt like a lead weight in my right hand. My left arm stiffened to resist Norma's gentle tug. Incredulity swept over me. I felt a tingling along the nape of my neck, as though my hair was rising. Here was a respected, prominent Boston businessman, the vice president and second in command of the largest firm of its kind in New England, a man with an area-wide and even nationwide reputation for his business specialty. I had met him several times in business clubs, at whose luncheons he usually occupied a place at the head table. A vast man, shaggy, unkempt, affable, slow-moving, factual. His wife was active in church and civic affairs. His children were college students. The top position he held in his firm gave him wide esteem along State Street. The job he did was looked upon as a tremendous asset to New England's commercial and industrial life. He was a frequent contributor of lead articles to trade journals in his field. A trifle eccentric, given to wearing sloppy and threadbare clothes and energetically supporting progressive movements, he was excused by conservative Bostonians because of his warm personality, his hearty affability, and his intrinsic gentleness. He was an ardent supporter of Henry Wallace and the Progressive Citizens of America, where I had worked with him on membership and organizational campaigns. Some of his friends thought his political activities a bit odd, but they said of him, "He means well and he's such a good guy." And now, here he sat, in a deeply secret meeting of communists. I started to perspire. The conversation in the room died, and in the silence I felt eyes turned upon me. The surprise, the acute embarrassment, the panic of my discovery that this man was an intimate of communists, gave way to fear. Fear that I had stumbled upon a carefully guarded secret of the Communist Party, and that for some reason, I stood now on the verge of betrayal as an FBI undercover agent. The sweat beaded my forehead and trickled down my back. I tore my gaze from the level eyes of the big, crumpled man on the sofa, glanced quickly around the room, and forced a smile. "Come in," Norma insisted, nudging my elbow. I struggled for a coherent thought to banish the shocked expression I was sure covered my face. I dropped the satchel of pamphlets and books heavily, just inside the door, and reached for my handkerchief. I wiped the sweat from my face and around my collar, and recovered my breath. "Golly," I gasped to Norma in an effort to explain my obvious discomfort, "I'll bet those fiendish stairs will keep your figure. How in the world do you manage to haul your groceries up here?" The polite laughter, directed at the plump hostess by my side, dispelled the tension. "Phew," I added with feeling. But the ordeal was not yet over. The problem of greeting remained. I was still standing in the frame of the doorway, as if transfixed by a spotlight. "When in trouble, smile," I said to myself, and I did. despite my horror. Then I thought of the incongruity of the situation, the joke on myself, knowing this man for years, without the slightest intimation that he might be a communist. The smile that started as an effort turned into the real thing, and I was actually laughing at myself as I moved across the room toward him. "Well," I said, as I grasped the hand that he extended as he remained seated, "I'm certainly glad to see you here, comrade. I must admit I'm surprised." "I suspected you knew each other," Norma said. I had control of myself once more. "Now meet these other people. Teddy, Jackie, Faith, Butch, Peg, Helen. This is Herb." There was only one among them who I knew well, Comrade Teddy, a pert, pretty career girl, was an executive assistant to one of the leading non-communist figures in PCA. In this position, she was a veritable pipeline of information from the top level of the PCA to the Communist Party. She had access to PCA plans, platforms, and decisions even before the membership. She knew thoroughly the organization's sources of income, political contacts. Now she greeted me with a superior little smile. Others in the room I knew vaguely from work I had done previously in other communist front groups. When the introductions were over, I found a chair in the far corner of the room and dropped into it. A communist is all things to all people. Some regard him as an intellectual, essentially harmless but intense, spouting Marxism in abstruse terms. Another thinks of a communist as a tough-fisted labor leader swinging a club on a picket line. Others as a sinister professor, a suave diplomat, a swarthy saboteur, a bomb-throwing assassin. But every non-communist, no matter what his station in life, is usually quite sure of one thing, that there are no hardened, disciplined communists in his immediate circle of friends and acquaintances. No one he knows well and likes could possibly be among those who attend secret meetings and listen to discussions of revolution, violence, and the rise of the proletariat. Each man has a few friends he regards as radical, perhaps, but none of them, he is sure, would go so far as to conspire. None preaches civil strife or believes in it. Those who do that sort of thing live in a world apart. They are shadowy figures in the darkness of unreality, fictional characters who occasionally break into the headlines as atom spies or communist couriers, but they are not real. The average American cannot conceive of a communist revolutionary living next door to him or occupying the desk just across the aisle. So I had always thought. In spite of all my experiences over the years as a working communist, I had convinced myself that the ardent members of the party, although I knew them and worked with them, belonged in a different world. Few of them could have been my good friends under any circumstances. I looked upon them as actors to be watched on a stage, who lingered only as illusions when I left the theater. I recognized their threat, their insidiousness, and their perfidy, but I never accepted them as an integral part of my own life, until that evening, when I was forced to a sudden awakening. The discussion leader for the night was launching into his discourse. "We are sorry you were unable to be here when we started our detailed study of the state and revolution," he said, holding up a book. I became aware that he was speaking to me. "You know this work of Lenin's, don't you?" "Oh, yes," my voice responded. "I've studied it before. I know it well. The doctrine of the state and revolution, with its political and philosophical analysis of the powers of government and its discussions of the requirements of a successful revolution, was usually strong medicine even for me, a hardened pupil of many communist classes, but here in this atmosphere of muted gentility, among a group of well-groomed and carefully mannered professional people, with one of Boston's business leaders seated across from me, listening impassively. It was unbelievable. We have seen in our previous discussion," the leader droned on, "that the origins of the state are in capitalism itself, and the state is the product of the irreconcilable character of class antagonisms, and that this power arising from society becomes more and more separated from it. The state then becomes an instrument for the oppression and exploitation of the working class." I looked at my friend on the sofa, certain that the ludicrousness of the situation would bring the smile back to his face. "The Social Democrats," I was hearing, "the Browderites, and the Socialists have distorted the words of Engels to mean that the capitalist state can go through a process of withering away, can be changed for the better without a revolution. But the correct steps which must be taken are, contrary to the vulgarizers of Engels, very clearly indicated. The big man across the room apparently accepted with perfect equanimity the fact that I, assistant advertising director of the largest entertainment organization in New England, Sunday school teacher, youth leader, should also be here, in a nest of communists, listening to a discussion of the state and how to overthrow it. I wondered if it had been a surprise to him, or if he actually regarded it as normal. First, the proletariat must destroy the capitalist state. The capitalist state will not wither away of its own accord and cannot be transformed. It must be destroyed. Second, the special repressive force of the capitalists must be replaced by another special repressive force, the proletarian state. Third, the proletarian state will wither away, but only after the consolidation of the dictatorship, and only after the destruction of all remnants of capitalism. There was a question period after the discussion. Our hostess Norma, who I discovered was a newcomer to the group herself, holding the first meeting at her own apartment, was disturbed that democracy would also disappear after the revolution. Democracy under capitalism, it was explained, was merely another form of the bourgeoisie state, and it, too, must be destroyed. But if there was any question of the group's not understanding the lesson, it was dispelled in the summary given by the discussion leader. The replacement of the bourgeoisie state by the proletarian state is impossible without a violent revolution. The abolition of the proletarian state, in turn, is only possible through withering away when it is no longer necessary as a controlling force. After the meeting was over, feeling weak from the shock of that evening, I excused myself as quickly as possible, driving home in a mood of black despair. I could not put out of my mind the thought that in a world of such rude jolts, there was constant peril that I might be discovered. Every member of the party, and certainly every member of this elite group into which I had now been introduced, was under constant suspicion and under a careful scrutiny of party security agents. The slightest defection, the smallest slip, might bring unpleasant consequences. I must work out some special defenses. The first thing was to strengthen my Marxism, to practice more and more the mental attitude of the Marxist revolutionary. I must be more careful to place myself in the proper frame of mind before each meeting. I must never walk through a doorway, turn a corner on a street, meet a friend, talk with a stranger, or answer a telephone without having my guard alert and ready. But the most difficult task facing me was also the most essential. There was one vulnerable spot, which had to be eliminated. It meant cutting down one of the guideposts of my life and accepting the tragic fact. Where communism is concerned, there is no one who can be trusted. Anyone can be a communist. Anyone can suddenly appear in a meeting as a Communist Party member, close friend, brother, employee, or even employer, leading citizen, trusted public servant. Now I could understand the instructions of the party leaders when I first joined. Your membership will be secret. Don't separate yourself from the masses. Maintain your normal ties and lead a perfectly normal life. Anyone can do that, I reflected. No one is safe. No one can be trusted. There is no way to distinguish a communist from a non-communist. Well, I hope you see now that they're everywhere, and that hasn't changed. In fact, I'd say they're probably more out in the open than they ever were before. So this is an interesting one because they've basically got Herb stuck in some boring thing. He's not getting anywhere. He's not being useful to the FBI, and he's probably frustrated thinking about getting out of this thing. And shortly after he says that, and he has that attitude, that they come and they put him in this secret, super secret floater role. And he walks in the room, and this is great. He says, "There on the sofa, slouched in a shadow and not at first apparent, watching me with a slow smile on his massive face, was a man, an old friend, the last man in the world I ever expected to find at a meeting of the Communist Party." And this happens again in another chapter pretty soon. But it's even a bigger shock then. So, and it shouldn't be, you know, this keeps happening, but this is how crafty they are. They're so good at what they do. This is what evil does. Evil is very good at what it does. This is another one that I think should be made into a poster. A communist is all things to all people. Some regard him as an intellectual, essentially harmless but intense, spouting Marxism in abstruse terms. Another thinks of a communist as a tough-fisted labor leader swinging a club in a picket line. Others as a sinister professor, a suave diplomat, a swarthy saboteur, a bomb-throwing assassin. But every non-communist, no matter what his station in life, is usually quite sure of one thing, that there are no hardened, disciplined communists in his immediate circle of friends and acquaintances. So he is having a hard time coming to grips with this. Because surely nobody that I'm close with is a communist. And he would know because he is one, at least in the role as an informant for the FBI. He says that the average American cannot conceive of a communist revolutionary living next door to him or occupying the desk just across the aisle. So I had always thought, in spite of all my experiences over the years as a working communist, I had convinced myself that the ardent members of the party, although I knew them and worked with them, belonged in a different world. Few of them could have been my good friends under any circumstance. I looked upon them as actors to be watched on a stage who lingered only as illusions, and when I left the theater, I recognized their threat, their insidiousness, and their perfidy, but I never accepted them as an integral part of my own life. Until that evening, when I was forced into a sudden awakening. Man, he's so deep in this, he doesn't even know. And when his stuff just comes and slaps him in the face, he's still having a hard time understanding it. In their teachings for the lesson in his little group, they said, the replacement of the bourgeoisie state by the proletarian state is impossible without a violent revolution. Let me read that again. The replacement of the bourgeoisie state, that'd be all of you, by the proletarian state is impossible without a violent revolution. What do you think we've been seeing in these cities across the country throughout the year? And this final paragraph is very powerful, but the most difficult task facing me was also the most essential. There was one vulnerable spot which had to be eliminated. It meant cutting down one of the guideposts of my life and accepting the tragic fact. Where communism is concerned, there is no one who can be trusted. Anyone can be a communist. Anyone can suddenly appear in a meeting as a Communist Party member, close friend, brother, employee, or even employer, leading citizen, trusted public servant. No one is safe. No one can be trusted. There is no way to distinguish a communist from a non-communist. So imagine he let his guard down. Imagine he wasn't good at his job and keeping the fact that he was an FBI informant secret. And he told someone who maybe was even considered a close friend or a neighbor that he believed was a local Republican Baptist or conservative or whatever. And he made that mistake and he told them. The Communist Party would find out. So he's come to this realization that he can't trust anyone, which must be a lonely place to be. And I've said before, I don't have what it takes to do what he did. I don't have that duplicitousness in me. I'm an open book. Jeffersonian, constitutional, Christian, conservative, libertarian leaning on some issues, open book. I hate communists, no secret there. And he's got this ability, and I've known others who have this, where they can be two people. I don't have that. Pretty amazing. Imagine your good friend or your closest coworker was a communist. You might never know it. And in this day and age, it's almost easier because, you know, they can just come across as a useful idiot or a fellow traveler, one of these dolts that is being used by the Democrats or by the socialists or by the outright communists in our country. Just some schlub. But you think, you know, they're just misguided. Oh, he means well. Wrong. that person might be a communist. Deep down, that person is a communist if they're advocating for positions that are the abolishment of the Constitutional Republic, which is a guaranteed form of government that we have in America. So, what an amazing man. That was chapter 15. So, I hope you're enjoying that. We're two-thirds of the way through the book and a little bit further to go. Some exciting news on the domain front here for Radio Free Virginia. I secured radiofreevirginia.com. There's a reason I have radiofreeva.com, because when I started the podcast, radiofreevirginia.com wasn't available. So I said, well, okay. And it wasn't being used. It wasn't like there was a podcast called, or anything called, Radio Free Virginia. They're just, somebody had bought the domain. And so I said, okay, well, just get another domain. The other night I'm on there, I was like, yeah, I haven't checked that in about a year, year and a half. Let's see. Boom, and it was available. Couldn't believe it. So I snatched it up. So that's pretty exciting. So I think what I'll do is just keep Radio Free VA the way it is and just forward that domain to the current site until I sort out what I'm going to do there. The next is, I've mentioned I've got some t-shirts that I'm working on. I've already got one designed, and I've got it up in the print on demand system. Here's the problem. I have not yet found a print on demand service that lets them host the website and do all the credit card processing and all that, which is interesting. Essentially, you've got these print on demand clearance houses, and they have suppliers that do print on demand, and essentially they facilitate the processing of the order. It's a drop shipping kind of, think of a middleman for drop shipping. Well, the problem for me is that I would have to set up an e-commerce site, which is fine. I can use PayPal. Would have to maintain and do all that stuff. I would have to deal with the sales tax, and it's much more complicated. It's not as simple as designing and here's a link to the thing and go buy it. So I'm going to do it. I've just got to sort out how to fit that in. There's not enough hours in the day to do half of the stuff I'm doing. And so I've just got to budget the time. But I've got the first shirt design, and it is the end quote by Jim Caviezel that I've been sharing at the end of every show. And so that's moving along. Thought of another good one. I think you all like this. A picture of a backhoe and maybe some dirt that's been dug in a ditch. And then say, building for the communist future. Something like that. you'll get the hidden meaning there. And here's the other thing. I've started to look at this and say, well, you can't, there's certain things they won't let you make. And so I have to be very careful about how I word things and how I say things. I can't just say, shoot all communists and dump them in a ditch. I can't say things like that. Saw a great video. It was Bumbles stumbling up the stairs to Air Force One, and somebody had clipped in a picture or a shot of Donald Trump hitting a golf ball with a driver and then superimposed a golf ball hitting Bumbles in the head and making him fall down multiple times. It was very funny. Unfortunately, it's what's going on in America is not funny, but we can at least laugh at some things. So, and that'll do it this week for another episode. Please tell your friends. Please share this everywhere. And please comment and like and follow this on your preferred podcast platform. I'm using Podbean, and that's the app that I've been using mostly. So, but if you do that, what that does is it helps tell the algorithms, hey, people like this, and then they share it with other people that like this, and on it goes. More people listening, more exposure out there, more information that can reach patriots, because that's who we want to reach. Remember, you were not made to fit in, you were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.